A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on August 31, 2003, entitled Religion, Response to Mystery Emerging Naturally, in the series The Fundamentals a Century Later. The texts for the sermon are Psalm 8, Acts 17, verses 16 through 23, and John 1, verses 1 through 5, and 14 through 18. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
Today I wrap up the summer series, unless I go back to it later. These weeks I have been looking at the fundamentals a century later. And the fundamentals, in a very positive sense, these were doctrines affirmed by conservative, responsible scholars in the face of the rise of liberal theology at the end of the 19th and early part of the 20th century. The conservative and orthodox tradition was being eroded. There was an explosion of knowledge of the natural world. There was the rise of historical thinking where people began to understand reality in terms of process and development. And the liberal tradition recognized that it had to face that which was empirically verifiable, and then in the face of that, figure out how to think and be religious. And so they had to dismantle any external authority and simply accept what was coming to expression, which was coming, becoming manifest, and then to say, okay, in the light of the world as it is, how does one live devotedly, with wonder and awe, reverence and gratitude, so on. For liberal theology recognized that the theological task was more one of interpretation of hermeneutics than it was of the interpretation of an absolutely definitive final creedal statement, some absolute truth that was given once for all. Because of the eroding tradition, the conservative scholars wrote these essays in order to affirm the faith, and they did so very responsibly, but I think the mistake that they made from this perspective, my perspective, is that they affirmed the faith very responsibly in terms of the faith understanding, its own understanding, but they did it in terms of a worldview that was passing away. And they failed to recognize that, of course, there was a worldview in the Bible, but the worldview wasn't what the Bible was about. Everybody has a worldview. Everybody, every generation has a worldview. It's just the commonly accepted conventional knowledge of the way things are. And so what came to expression in the Bible came to expression with a certain worldview. But that wasn't the important thing. But once you absolutize the book, then it seemed as though that worldview also was absolutized. And so it was a struggle, and it eventuated or it exacerbated the division between science and religion, and I think it's had a rather serious harvest in terms of the failure to be able, with freedom and confidence of the religious thinker, to continue to negotiate life's passages and to be open to knowledge from whatever discipline it comes. But the fundamental affirmations, again, were given in terms of an old worldview, and it was a consequence of absolutizing the text and having an absolute authority within which one had to work, whether it worked or not. And the failure was, I think, a failure to understand that religion is not about a series of truths. It's not about A, B, C, D. It's not something you can put down in a series of propositions. Religion is about finding meaning. The religious questions are life's ultimate questions. Why is there something rather than nothing? From whence have we come, and whither are we going? Why are we here? What is the meaning of it all? Those are the kinds of questions that the human family from its inception has inevitably raised, because our life is shrouded in mystery. To be human is to live in an existence that is surrounded by ultimate mysteries that are not just mysteries that one day will be unraveled, but ultimate mysteries, because in our humanity we will never be able to comprehend and to explicate that mystery that surrounds us, embraces us, undergirds us, overshadows us. That's the nature of our human experience. The Bible, the wonderful treasure of religious wondering and religious experiences. Psalm 8, it's just amazing. The poet, perhaps having gazed into the blackness of outer space, see the twinkling stars, the moon, in the heat of the day, the sun, wondering about the vastness of this planet which he was planted, a vastness that he didn't begin to understand in terms of the expanding universe that we know about. Nonetheless, the evening sky does instill awe in one. And he says, O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. When I consider the heavens, the sun, the moon, the stars that you've made, who am I? What is the mortal, the human being, that you should be mindful of us? And then he comes with a profound insight. And he becomes aware of, even in his limited sense of the expansive universe, that he is the one, this insignificant little blob of protoplasm, he is the one that is contemplating it all. So what are a billion years, and what is space into infinity? What is all of that if there is no mind to think it, no heart to take it in, no human awareness brought to awe and wonder? And so the psalmist, centuries and centuries ago, had that sense that something was emerging in the human, that God had brought the human to the point of awareness. Wow! And Paul in Athens, he's in the Academy of the Western World. Someone has said, I think it was Whitehead, all Western philosophy, a series of footnotes to Plato and Aristotle. And now Paul comes to Athens and he goes about the city and he's disturbed by the evidence of temples and statuary that represent the respective deities of the Greek people. And Paul, not appreciating that, being distressed in his spirit, is invited finally to the forum, to the Areopagus, where it's said rather disparagingly that the Athenians just like to sit there all day long and talk about something new. Well, you know, that's a kind of a put-down, but as a matter of fact, Athens, I've stood on Mars Hill with a little group of pilgrims and preached to them, and I'll tell you, it's really something. not the sermon, the experience. But Paul, Paul missed it, I think. How could you be in Athens in the shadow of the Parthenon and be distressed by the representation of the religious quest of a people? Well, because Paul thought, he, Paul, knew the God of Israel, who was God alone, the only true God, and that that God had intervened in history in Jesus Christ, and that history itself was about to be wrapped up, and Paul was on a mission. Paul's the kind of a convert that should be caged for 10 years before you let him loose. Preachers should too, when they come out of school. That would have been beneficial to this congregation if I had been isolated for a period of time. We understand what Paul was about. But my point is this. In the academy of the Western world, the heart and the source of Western civilization, there was the religious quest. There were all of those philosophical questions. And they were answering them in a variety of ways. And of course, Paul threw his own Christian gospel into that story. But the point is this. You see that to be human is to wonder. And to ask questions and to reflect, to come to consciousness and awareness of the embracing mystery of this experience of being human. If I would go to the passage I've gone back to again and again and becoming for me probably my core passage, it's that prologue to John's Gospel. Not because I think the author had some revelation of the cosmos as we know it, but just that his telling of the story of the incarnation can be so beautifully understood in terms of the cosmic drama of which we're aware. In the beginning was the Word, or in the beginning was the divine intention, and the divine intention became flesh, and no one has ever seen God but the only Son. He is the exegesis of the Father. He is the interpretation. The mystery now has a face. That infinite, infinite source of all that is has taken tangible and concrete form in the finite. That's an amazing, profound understanding. That in the human, there is the emergence of the divine. That in the human, in the consciousness and the awareness of the human, there is the emergence of that infinite source of all, becoming conscious of itself. And why should we hunger and long for reunion with the infinite? Why should we wonder about that? If that is our source, then it is also the longing for homecoming. Oh, that first chapter of John has all of that profundity in it, where the understanding again, something like the psalmist who began to put together his own human self-consciousness with an awareness of God, who said, "You have created us a little less than God." If you have the old King James Version, it says a little less than the angels, because the writers were afraid to say what the text really said. You have created us a little less than God. That's really something. These are religious questions, and these are religious insights, and that's what religion is all about. I tried to put it in a statement. Religion, colon, response to mystery emerging naturally. Now, there it is. It is response. it's not as though the human animal is natively religious. It is the human animal becoming conscious, is aware of living before the face of that which must be the creative source and ground of all that is. It's response. Something lures us. Something attracts us. Something beckons us. And so response to that mystery. The sacred, the holy, God, that ultimate response to that sense of being encountered by that which is calling us. Response to mystery emerging. The mystery itself is emerging. Process. Not divine fiat, bang, snap of the fingers, all at once, ready-made, boom. Process. You know, we are the first, relatively first human family that is aware of what we are aware of in terms of that 15 billion years of process. That process that took billions and billions and billions of years for life to emerge, and then more billions of years for life to become conscious. And we are still relatively newcomers in this whole cosmic drama, but mystery emerging, development, process, emerging naturally. Not the old idea of the clockmaker. God is the clockmaker, putting the pieces together and getting it go tick-tock, and then occasionally reaching in and adjusting the hands, tweaking it here and there, interrupting its natural process. No, the process, from all we can gather, this process is simply in motion. It is moving from its creative source, its generative center. Randomly, it would seem, to all we can figure out, it could have gone one way, it could have gone another way. It emerged, it has emerged in humankind. There has been an emergence of mystery naturally, an unfolding, a development to bring us here, talking about it, thinking about it, an amazing thing. And the amazing thing is that the randomness can now be interrupted by that which has emerged, for we have emerged and we can impact where it goes. We can destroy the planet, or we can bring shalom on earth. Biology is no longer our destiny. Evolution is no longer a locked in thing. We can affect it. We have emerged to the point where, well, can be like God, where we have, through our human decision-making power, our mind and our soul and heart, a shaping determination of what will follow. That's amazing. Religion is simply response to mystery emerging naturally. Let me tell you a story, and I'll let you go. A story that happened to me last weekend. About a year ago, a member of the church called, wanted to come in with his daughter, wanted to be married. Problem. She fell in love with a Jewish young man. I said, no problem for me. I'd be glad to do a joint service with the rabbi. A little while later, problem. The eastern side of the state, one of the large Jewish congregations, reform liberal rabbi didn't feel he could do a service with a Christian minister. I said, well, my friend Alan Alpert up in Muskegon, Rabbi Alpert, I think he would do it. They talked to him. They loved him. Long story short, worked out a service, which happened last week in the Amway Grand. And it's always great to work with Alan, Rabbi Alpert. He's such a dear man. And we put the service together with a couple, spent a couple hours putting it all together, all the pieces. Who would do this? Who would do that? He did the Hebrew parts. But in my little meditation to them, I said, you know, I said, one of my favorite musicals is Fiddler on the Roof. And I said, when I first experienced it as a musical, I loved it. And somebody said, well, what's the significance of the fiddler? And I was embarrassed to say, I haven't got the slightest idea. So when it came out in the film, I caught the opening scene. Here's this fiddler on this steep roof fiddling. And to be fiddling on a steep roof is precarious. And life is precarious. And so how do you keep your balance? Tradition. And so I said to these two, you both have wonderful traditions that have shaped and formed you. Now don't do as so many have done who have come across this way and just let them both go. I said, because they are so important to give you a life map, tell you who you are and help you. So, and I told him, I said, it's nothing new. Because in the Hebrew scriptures, in the book of Ruth, remember Naomi and Elimelech? It was famine in Israel. They went to Moab with their two sons to get food. And the two sons fell in love with Moabitess young ladies and got married. You know. But they had to eat, after all. And what were the boys going to do? And so they stretched a little bit there, and then, well, Elimelech died, and then the two sons died, and now here's Naomi with two daughter-in-laws who are Moabitess, and she wants to go back to Israel. And so she starts back, and they go back with her, and she says, look, I don't have any more sons in my womb. Please, just go back. Why should you come and be, you know, share my bitterness? Go to your people. And Orpha leaves, giving her a kiss. But Ruth says, implore me not to depart from you. For where you go, I will go. And your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. And where you are buried, I will be buried. And even in death, we will not be parted. Wow, it's a beautiful expression of a Moabitess young woman to a Jewish mother-in-law. Traditions transcended in love. And so I said to these kids, I said, you know what? What a fortunate time for you to have fallen in love. Because your parents flank you here, and neither one of them are embarrassed about this or wishing it wasn't so. And out there were 350 people. There were white yarmulkes all over the place. There were 200 Jewish people from the other side of the state. And I said, what a beautiful celebration. Because I said, we know now, today, we know that religious traditions are to shape us and to form us and to help us to find meaning, but not to isolate us and divide us. For they can be transcended in love and therefore mutually enriching. Well, the wedding's concluded. They broke the glass. And out they went. And Alan and I are under the huppah together. Rabbi Alpert. I looked at him and I said, Alan, when we step from under the huppah, I'm going to give you a hug. He said, okay. So he did. You know what happened? The place erupted. It erupted in applause. And the applause didn't quit until we got way down at the end of that long island. The wedding party had all already exited the hall. They didn't know what happened. And the applause didn't quit because the people had seen a symbol, they experienced a symbol of what down deep in their hearts they knew was deepest truth. So then the grand reception, and Jewish people know how to have a party, I tell you, they know how to do a wedding. There was wonderful music, a great band, and vocalists, and it was just marvelous. And all of a sudden, this quiet, and one of the uncles or whatever, a Jewish man, took the loaf of bread and intoned some Hebrew over it, and I said to Nancy, "Oh, they asked me to say grace." And I said, "I put the prayer in my portfolio and I brought it up to the room." She said, "Go get it." I said, "There's no time. Maybe they'll forget about it." When the soloist says, "And now, Reverend Rem." So I walk up there. Of course, it's in the joy and celebration of this moment. So I just gave a little prayer. You know what happened? Place erupted in applause again. It did. And as I went to my seat, they were saying, "Bravo, bravo," for a blessing over the bread. And what was happening? People were experiencing a moment of truth. They were experiencing concretely what they know down in their depths, that good religion does not divide, but unites. That good religion does not denigrate, but affirms. That good religion enables us to transform all that would divide us and gives us the possibility of global community. That's where I trust we're moving. 12 or 15 years ago, my dear friends, because of my religion, I could not have been the facilitator of that kind of joy and truth. So I know this is not incidental stuff. This is as critical and as important as the possibility of peace on earth, living in the abyss of God's love, the God who holds the whole world and all the children in God's hand.